pica se ha transformado en una lección de derechos humanos para la Unión Americana. Beatriz Salas amplía la información.
Decidir sobre quiénes serán los portadores de la antorcha en la ceremonia inaugural de los Juegos Olímpicos de Invierno en Pekín es la responsabilidad de China, y Estados Unidos no está en posición de hacer comentarios despectivos. Así respondió Pekín a la reciente interferencia de Washington, quien aseveró que la elección de China del atleta de la etnia Uyghur, Denijir Dilamujian, para llevar la antorcha olímpica es un esfuerzo de Pekín para distraer la atención del llamado genocidio en la región de Xinjiang.
Los llamados comentarios de genocidio de Estados Unidos son la gran mentira del siglo y exponen su intento de politizar los Juegos Olímpicos de Invierno y su siniestra intención de utilizar el tema relacionado con Xinjiang para difamar a China.
China asimismo acusó a Estados Unidos de mentir de manera descarada sobre las minorías étnicas, mientras olvida sistemáticamente discriminaciones en su propio suelo.
Estados Unidos llevó a cabo un genocidio contra los nativos americanos en el pasado y ha discriminado sistemáticamente a las minorías raciales a largo plazo. La población de nativos americanos se ha desplomado de 5 millones a finales del siglo XV a unos 250 mil a principios del siglo XX, reduciéndose a una vigésima parte. ¿Qué es el genocidio? Las políticas que Estados Unidos ha impuesto a los nativos americanos son un verdadero genocidio.
Zhao, además de criticar la discriminación racial contra los africanos y asiáticos en Estados Unidos, dijo que elegir a un atleta de la etnia Uyghur muestra que la política de China de promover los deportes de invierno y mejorar la salud de las personas está beneficiando a individuos de todos los grupos étnicos y prueba que no existe discriminación.
Lo que Estados Unidos debería estar haciendo es revisar cuidadosamente sus propios crímenes históricos contra los nativos americanos y tomar medidas concretas para reducir la discriminación racial contra estas personas y otras minorías raciales, como los africanos y asiáticos.
China, en reiteradas ocasiones, ha instado a Estados Unidos a dejar de usar los asuntos vinculados con Xinjiang para difundir mentiras, interferir en los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas con información de Niloufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos pues en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga dignos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
Told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
I got three quarters of the way through several times and was like, well, I have no idea how this would end, so I have to start over. But one thing I know is I can't end a story without hope.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Nicaragua's NGO Purge targets its oldest queer group. Gay Taiwanese movie sings out a universal love song and upending the artistic process with Amanda Kayback. All that and more this week because you've discovered...
Oh, it is flashback time. That is the July 13th edition of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, the Thursday evening show coming up, is going to be two flashbacks. One to December 26th, 1999. I think it's a partial flashback to that show because I don't think we have the whole show. And then another partial flashback to December 30th, the next show, which I believe was a Thursday show. So you're going to get the last part of the December 26th Sunday show. And looks like most of the December 30th show. December 26th show begins with discussion of a Cleveland loss for homeless folks in Cleveland, Ohio. And then interviews and discussions on the street with Steve Sullivan, the Pied Piper, Laura Tucker, working with the Homeless Issues Task Force and talking about other issues as well. Host misinformation that apparently was given out. That's the eyes and ears or the snitches for the police, as they were then known in those days. I've heard more positive things about the host since then, but I haven't really been enough downtown, heard enough accounts to really give you good information there. Then we have a long interview from early December with attorney and activist David Beauvais, who is defending a group of naked players called the Explicit Players. And then interviews from Telegraph Avenue about police harassment there. And finally, Julia Vinograd's poetry from 1999, 20 years before she died. One of her... I wouldn't call it her early days. She was writing in the 70s and even in the 60s. But her middle period, perhaps. All of this was from December 26th. Then we go to December 30th. We have James Ney as a co-host. James was an activist who now kind of is a retired, I believe. And we get to hear him. He and I are discussing busts in L.A. and the Pershing Park. We have call-ins from Skidmark Bob and the V-Man about police problems and also a dead body. We have Robert Steffen interviewing him briefly after he won his case and finally was allowed to go back to his bench. That's the Pink Umbrella Man who was at that time the man in the garbage can, no, the garbage bag, running for president, who Bunny Shoes wanted to evict from the public bench and did for a month or more. Then there's a discussion of a guy who just got 5 days in jail to get another jaywalking ticket, how he felt about it, an interview with a man who characterizes himself as Black Man in America. Then we have myself, Linda LeMaster, Roxana Quistapache, and Becky Johnson talking before the closed session of the Shitty Council on December 14th, 1999, opposing the kick out all the tenants, but don't give them really adequate relocation funding in the so-called Dolphin Lee project. And we have commentary from Beach Flats resident Phil Baer and, of course, perennial council watcher, scope it out, Scott Graham. All that is coming up, and I believe there's even some music included with these segments of, and I wish I had more, I wish I had the full shows of these December 99 shows, but you get to hear them now, and there'll be some actual original material on Sunday when I'm able to sort of get myself in gear, and I'll have to do a little bit more outreach on the streets, but pretty sure I'll have some more stuff that's actually from the here and now 2023 at that time. So don't go away. If you have questions or comments or complaints, give me a call on the Huff line. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. And we're at, as it might be appropriate, 831-423-HUFF or 423-4833. And perhaps most important, if you are observing anything going on around the ongoing sweeps that apparently have not stopped, particularly around the edges of Santa Cruz, like up in the Lower Meadow, the Poganip area, and in other places, driving away people from, there is no real place for them to go, give me a call and let me know about it. Take pictures of it, post them online, and get in touch with us so we can actually consider ways to protect those folks, the kind of people that are being confronted with this in the future. Again, 423-4833.
427-3772. Easy to call. Just start pushing those buttons. 427-3772. I was talking to City Council archivist, habitué, I would say even expert, Scott Graham, earlier today. He brought to my attention, I guess it was December 24th or thereabouts, a ruling in Cleveland around the issue of the police and the homeless. So I finally was able to find in the Plain Dealer, which is the local Cleveland paper, a story, White calls homeless ruling a win for the city, Saturday, December 25th, and I'm going to read that story now. A federal judge gave the city a victory Thursday night by allowing police to continue forbidding homeless people from sleeping on downtown's most visible sidewalks, Mayor Michael R. White said yesterday. White applauded the same ruling that won praise Thursday night from advocates of the homeless, who earlier that day sought a court order stopping city police from ordering homeless people to move on or be arrested. The American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, and homeless advocates had characterized Chief U.S. District Judge Paul Mattia's late-night ruling as a setback for the city and a victory for the homeless. In a prepared statement released yesterday, Mayor White expressed his pleasure with Mattia's decision, which he said permits the city to continue enforcing its policy of protecting the rights of downtown visitors, including prohibiting aggressive panhandling and sleeping on sidewalks. Mattia's order temporarily directs the city to stop, quote, impeding homeless people from sleeping on sidewalks, but specifically makes an exception for the downtown area bounded by West 10th Street on the west, East 13th Street on the east, the Lake Erie shore on the north, and Euclid Avenue to the south. Mattia allowed the city to prevent homeless people from sitting, lying, reclining, or sleeping upon sidewalks within that delineated area. Mattia's order does not include the flats in its no-sleeping zone. We're talking about Ohio here, folks. The delineated central business district, with its proliferation of hotels and retail stores, has been the city's prime concern and main focus for its sweep and enforcement. White noted, on Thursday, the negotiators originally discussed exempting certain downtown buildings before settling on the more general boundary. But Mattia also ordered the city to, quote, refrain from ordering homeless loiterers to move along unless those people were engaging in, quote, bona fide disruptive or criminal conduct. While we are sympathetic to the plight of the homeless, we'll continue to enforce our laws as permitted by Judge Mattia, White said. We are pleased that we can continue to respect the right of all citizens, including those individuals who are coming downtown to work, live, shop, visit, or enjoy the holiday season, and dump money in the coffers of our local merchants, of course. The city does not consider sleeping on a public sidewalk to be against the law, but police do arrest anyone obstructing the public right-of-way, being disorderly, or violating other laws, White said. Last month, the mayor increased police patrols downtown and in the flats and directed police to order homeless sleepers, to either move to a shelter or spend the night in jail. The policy, White said, was designed to increase safety for Christmas shoppers and New Year's revelers. Lawyers for the ACLU decided the safety of the homeless was more the issue. They showed up at the closed federal courthouse Thursday seeking a restraining order to prohibit police from telling homeless people huddling over warm sidewalk steam grates to move. And apparently, they got it, though it's not clear here, because if both the mayor and the ACLU likes it, then it's rather confusing, and I'm going to have to get a copy of that actual decision and see what was said by Judge Mattia in Cleveland. It is interesting, however, that we don't have any ACLU lawyers going to our closed courthouse and looking for an injunction against them arresting people for sleeping. And they don't just do it on the downtown, folks. We're talking about the Bushes, the Pogonip, the University of California area, the beaches, you name it, the tracks. So, you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And, boy, we have some time for once to proceed. Let's take a musical break. Sounds like a silent break. That's a tape problem, so we will deal with that. And check out this interview.
A happy camper, that man who reads on Pacific Avenue fearlessly. You have a pseudonym for us or a real name? Or should we call you Aurea?
Just call me Camper.
So, Camper, I see you have a little quick stop cup in front of you, somewhat tattered, but green, with a dollar bill at least in it. Have you been doing a good business here on the Avenue?
Actually, I'm really surprised that people aren't being as generous as they ordinarily are and stuff. I guess a lot of it has to do with, everybody's running on plastic nowadays or buying their presents on the Internet. So as for the panhandler on the street, we're just not doing as good as we were in the past years.
So let's get some sort of quantitative estimate. Like 2 years ago, what did you take in a day around this season?
Around the season, about $25, and now I'm lucky if I can even make 12.
And are you yourself living outside?
Yes. I live in the town of Felton up in the San Lorenzo Valley. And
Illegally camping, perhaps?
Possibly.
I see. Officer, keep an eye on this man. Have you seen any signs of rampant commercialism?
Rampant commercialism?
Yes.
Oh, of course. Of course. It's everywhere. You know, I can't believe it. I mean, like, you pay, turn on the radio and everything is, thisandthat.com.
I'm talking about anti-homeless, anti-commercialism, where they are, should we say, sweeping homeless people off the streets in order to pretty up the neighborhood for the tourists.
To be honest with you, no, I haven't.
Have you been out here much?
Yes.
So, for example, how many hours a day have you been on the street the last few days?
Probably about five at least.
Really? Good. Because I know last night we saw a large series of sweeps going on around Hippie Planter up here by New Leaf, where apparently Officer Over was in overdrive or overkill, as he often is, and was harassing someone, actually took up their pack and was making off with it, claiming it was abandoned property, and then got into a discussion about how these were vermin on the street who just didn't understand that this was a district concerned with entertainment and shopping, and why were they there. When we was told, what about the rights of homeless people, he said, homeless people have no rights. Officer Over, the man who, should we say, is the Christmas spirit of the Santa Cruz Police Department. So anyway, I was just wondering if there had been any. These were claims that were made. I did not actually record this. These were claims by individuals who were there as to what he said. Anything you want to add for Free Radio Santa Cruz?
I could say Merry Christmas to everybody. That's one thing for sure.
And ho, ho, ho. And all. Ha, ha, ha. We also have a man who has been, should we say, adding a little poetry to the Avenue. How's everything with you, sir?
Oh, things are fine.
And has the street been treating you well?
Rather well, as a matter of fact.
Any comments or perhaps poetry for the folks out there for Christmas?
Ooh, I don't really do Christmas, so I'm up the climb.
Excellent. A sane man among the loony asylum. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, in front of Jackson's Shoes, and observe some sort of ne'er-do-well guy with a number of flutes and a bizarre-looking jester's hat. Your name, sir?
It was 19 years ago that I came here to Jackson's Shoes and bought a pair.
So you're an old customer.
I'm still not wearing those shoes.
Well, it looks like you have an interesting pair of shoes on, but can you do a soft shoe on the pavement? I don't know. You're a man who's known for a number of things. You're a musician, you're a writer, you're a radio commentator at different times.
You know?
City planner.
One thing that hardly anyone knows.
Yeah. Merry Christmas.
Oh, thank you, man. How you been?
Good. And, you know, without being further interrupted...
Sorry about that.
I left those shoes in an orchard in Chico when I was being pursued by UFOs. I thought that the shoes were the bug, but I later discovered that there was a bigger bug.
UFOs were bugging you.
That's right, yeah.
So you left your dancing shoes in Chico. This could be the name of a new movie, but we're not going to get into that this time.
We're not going to get into it at any time, actually.
Well, I would hope not. Particularly some of my friends in high places might find that rather suspicious.
If your friends are in high places, then...
Actually, they're high friends in low places, but we won't get into that either.
I guess you don't know much about UFOs.
Very little. I know a number of city council members who look like they came... I don't know where they came from.
It's common knowledge now they have the underground bases on Mars, Moon, and the Earth.
Police station underneath?
No, the UFOs. And they've advised the U.S. government to build their cities underground because we have an upcoming apocalypse, maybe in another 12 years.
What about the so-called millennium? I'm waiting for the apocalypse next week. I don't want to hear any of this wait 12 years shit, if you don't mind.
I'm sorry.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Any comments about the street scene before we leave you to your Jamba juice drink?
Well, it's no longer piss on earth. You have to piss on the pavement.
You know, we do have porta potties downtown for your kind, if you don't mind. Thanks to the Crone Crapper Commission, the Commission on Bathrooms, they've actually put in some porta potties. Rumor has it. Actually, I know there's one back of Logos, and there are also three or four others, but nobody's got a map of them. They're in sort of hidden locations. Anything else?
Else? Four-letter word.
Well put. Talk to you later then, Uncle Steve.
Pied Piper.
Pied Piper.
Okay, it's about 6:30. We're talking to Laura Tucker on December 5th, 1999. And you, Laura, have a concern about what happened on December 2nd. Tell us about that.
Well, I don't know what happened, but I had heard secondhand from a friend that another friend, Eric, had been... what I heard was completely inaccurate, that he had been jumped by troll busters, and the next day they found out they were cops, and, you know, everything had exploded out of proportion. But anyway, so I was concerned about him and hadn't talked to him yet. And
Eric actually gave us a report that he and a friend had been followed, and that somebody he didn't know but met named Jason was, in fact, jumped the next night by individuals who showed badges, but who were not in uniform, and who apparently... beat him, and then gave him. And a police officer showed up and took him to jail. That was the story that Eric told me about Jason.
Right, and
the incident you're mentioning happened the night after the incident with Jason, and two nights after Eric spoke about he and a friend being pursued by police up near Natural Bridges, not by police, but by some individual in a white pickup truck with a spotlight.
A couple of individuals in a white pickup truck and a spotlight, and then just a few minutes later, a cop car showed up and started searching the same area with their spotlight. So that's a little suspicious anyway. And then the next night, the way I heard it was this guy was going to go get the troll busters, you know, and they showed him badges and called him and had him arrested.
Did he report he was beaten? Because that's what Eric told me about Jason, if we're talking about Jason.
Yeah, apparently he was, but originally it wasn't known that they were actually cops.
Right, and also, of course, it was the story from Eric is that Jason was released later that night. He was arrested as drunk and released without charges.
Yeah. I think the problem with this is that...
We're arguing with secondhand accounts.
Well, we're not only dealing with secondhand accounts, but we're dealing with people who don't want to be known. They don't want to. I mean, we've talked about this over and over again. But, I mean, for instance, I know that it wasn't someone that he just met, and it's just that he doesn't want to become vulnerable. And so...
Well, what happened the next day on December
2nd? Well, I was concerned about my friends, because there's a group of them. Some of them I know more than others. But
basically,
well, just people that are out there on the street, and they hang out all in certain areas that I know. And so... I was looking for Eric to find out what had happened firsthand, and I saw a cop car parked. I was just telling you, I don't know if I really need to be interviewed about this, but anyway, I saw a cop car parked at the top of the mall right there at that triangle where the statue is, and three cops standing around, and then...
About what time?
About 6 o'clock at night, in the evening, and then I saw two more cops... On the other side of the Asian Rose restaurant, which is one of the restaurants that feeds people in that area. And then I saw another cop with his billy club out, walking across the street towards the bottom of the steps there, kind of...
bottom of the steps, what steps?
As I said before, on the job host, Cynthia, is doing her last day after a two-month stint.
This is an interview from December 24th, 1999.
You good?
Yeah.
And, you know, the hosts take a lot of flack from me and other homeless advocates for, well, we call them the eyes and ears of the police because they are, you know, supposed to be informing people about the kind of merchant-dominated downtown ordinances, make it illegal to sit on the sidewalk near a store. And, of course, we'll continue to get that kind of flack, and I'm glad to hear you're moving on to another position. How has your view of the host been? Any comments on what you've seen, what you've been doing? What is most of your work constituted? How do you spend an average day?
My average shift is a 10-hour shift from 10 in the morning until 8 p.m. The majority of my time is spent giving people directions, suggesting places to eat, helping people with any kind of, like yesterday, an elderly couple lost their car downtown, and so we had the other hosts and the CSO, the community service officers, and a couple of the security guards from First Alarm looking for their car. We found it, and then I drove them to their car because they had wandered so far away from it.
So this is an elderly middle-class couple, not an elderly poor couple, right?
Oh, I don't know.
I mean, in other words, we're talking about someone who was shopping
down there. They were
foreigners.
Foreigners. Yeah,
right. So
they were foreigners.
Right. Now, what about, let's say, a homeless person looking for shelter? What do you do in that situation?
Well, actually, I did see a homeless person that was sitting in the foyer of a vacant building, and I invited him to come down to the Downtown Information Center, where I gave him a myriad of contacts and got him together with the social worker, who then got him his SSI payments going and enabled him to go and dry out at the detox center and get back on his feet again.
This happened yesterday?
This happened last week.
And you've been doing this for two or three months now?
2 months, yeah.
How many times has this happened where you've actually been able to connect a homeless person with effective social services?
For me, it's been about a half a dozen. About six people.
And how many people have inquired or have sought that kind of help?
Just many.
So it's really kind of a small fraction you were actually able to help.
It does tend to be because a lot of people really, they don't want help. They just sort of want some temporary shelter or whatever. They enjoy their lifestyle, and so we help them how we can. But most of the time, they don't want a lot of help. They just want a little bit of help.
Well, I know throughout the summer, the head of the Homeless Services Center told me that they just didn't have any shelter for anybody on an emergency basis. They had 30 beds that were taken up all the 30 floor spaces that were taken up all the time. So you weren't here during the summer. I'm sure you didn't know about that. Now you have the Armory floor, which is open up until it hits 100, and then it gets closed. What do you do when somebody comes to you and says, you know, I'm cold? I mean, other people, there are people who are here at night.
Yeah.
What's your answer to those folks?
Well, we do our best to help them. We'll call as many people as we need to call to get them the shelter or the blankets or whatever clothing, whatever it is that they need. We'll do our best to get it for them, even if we take something of our. I mean, I would give something of my own if I had extra.
As we all should.
To someone who was in need.
What do you do when you see a woman standing with a sign that says, I don't know, we'll work for food, let's say, over by the curb, as I've seen people doing. Let's say, I'm sorry, sitting on a bench with such a sign. Do you have any problem with that, a person sitting down with a sign?
I have no problem with that at all.
Because I know that Officer Malotti apparently misinformed numerous hosts that it was somehow illegal to sit down with a sign, when in fact your own literature in your office says that peacefully holding a sign while in a seated position is in fact legal.
That was a mistake. We are all human, fallible. That was a mistake. And if it were me, and I made that mistake, I would personally go to that person and say, because I know that person, I know who you're referring to, and I would go...
There were actually four or five of them, and they were all elderly women.
But. I would go to that... I know one in particular you're talking about, and I would go to her personally, and I would say, what's your name? I'm Cynthia. I made a mistake, and I am sorry. And you can hold your sign. And I know that that was something that fueled the demonstration that occurred out in front of our offices. And I didn't know at the time what had happened.
That's no longer the case?
I found out a week later, and we actually had a meeting with Sergeant Sanders, and we have been bantering this issue back and forth, because there are certain rights or, you know, things that are not illegal that these people can do, and we do not have a right to tell them they can't. We just simply don't. And these are a couple of the things that I believe the program needs to be updated, renovated. It's getting some new blood. We have a new executive director of the Downtown Association, Pete.
Peter Eberle.
Peter Eberle, and he is really wonderful as far as being able to take criticisms, and I had some criticisms about the program. He was very open to it, and he's in the process of pumping some new blood into the program.
Since you are leaving, and perhaps can speak more freely because of that, what were those criticisms?
Oh, I think we need a new uniform. We look terrible in these uniforms, these shirts, and
these green-shirted goblins, as we like to call you.
Yeah, with the stenciled downtown host on the back. I am not leaving because I'm unhappy. I'm leaving because it was a part-time job for me, and I got
paying. Pays how much an hour?
About $8, I think.
Right.
And I got a job in my chosen career, which is music. So I'm moving on, but. This is a month ago. Gina and I started talking. She's been with the program. She's a supervisor now. Bob will be coming back.
I've seen Bob on the street. He's back in town.
Yeah, he's coming back.
Fellow in the wheelchair who had
an accident on a cruise ship.
Up in Palo Alto, yeah.
Uh-huh.
He's been there for a while.
So, yeah. One of the things was, you know, changing the uniform. The other thing was to back off of the security a little bit and focus on the hospitality more. To focus on, you know, generating a good feeling about us. I noticed right away there's a stigma attached because of way back when after the earthquake, they started the program, and they really needed some heavy security for a lot of the South End stuff that was going on. This is all stuff that I'm hearing.
We have a different view.
Right, I'm sure you. I'm sure.
Actually, the program started in '95. It was not '94 or '95. The earthquake happened in '89.
It was five years later. Because of the so many large groups of people that people didn't want to come down to shop. The merchants were concerned and wanted to somehow make it more
merchants
comfortable.
Merchants have always wanted to disperse poor people from the downtown.
Yeah.
It just happened after the earthquake. The merchants were able to form a coalition with the city council because of the crisis, and the city council then began to issue the merchants' edicts as though it was the city council's own. So, in fact, the reality is there wasn't a lot of difference. I mean, it's true that there was a problem because of redevelopment, and it's true they wanted to draw people into the downtown area, but this cry that homeless people sitting down or, you know, people hanging around in groups who are young somehow makes it unwelcome other people has been a constant cry of the merchants for the last 25 years. It's nothing new.
And I think it's something that should people should be a little more tolerant and accept the fact that others have different types of lifestyles. It's the type of behavior that when they get into the people's faces and, you know, they start to badger them for money or whatever, that's the kind of behavior that they wanted the hosts to help to subside. And I think that has helped immensely. But now
badgering of a sort, like holding up a sign quietly.
No, not badgering. No, I'm speaking verbally.
Right. I'm referring to the behavior of Officer Malate, who was engaging in the same kind of abusive treatment of older people a year ago, and a month ago was doing exactly the same thing. So I tend to get rather passionate about it because I see no change. At least I didn't until you're talking to me, and apparently there has been some change, and I'm pleased to hear that. You know, and
I've been talking about it a lot.
Or acting on it?
Well, we need to act on it as well. I personally act on it.
I take action
as a person.
Sounds like you. How about other hosts?
Other hosts, I think Gina has become more aware of it. I don't work with the
other. Is there generally a dictate that informs people that the hosts have to follow the law and not harass people sitting down with signs?
Yeah, they do. But you know what? The law is really foggy sometimes. And when someone like Officer Malati tells you something, you know, you tend to believe in what he's saying because he's with the police department and so forth, you think that, you know, it's going to be accurate. But even he can misunderstand. And many people can make a misunderstanding of how the law is written.
It's hard to believe Officer Melotti can misunderstand a year later after he has been informed.
Yeah.
The downtown codes are pretty clear. They say solicitation shall not include the passive holding of a sign.
Right.
And that is, in fact, a part of your downtown ordinance little flyer you give out. How Officer Melotti can actually misunderstand that after he was specifically directed by the city attorney a year ago not to do that is still a mystery to me. Maybe he needs to go back to training school. And the reason I sound so upset is because I cannot believe this is a misunderstanding. I have to believe that he simply has his own private agenda on how to deal with people he regards as undesirable downtown.
I don't know anything about that. I've never seen him behave that way. I personally haven't ever seen him
behave that way.
You're obviously upset about something, so, it's not...
Well, I like to think I was a calm guy, but I do get upset. I'm upset when I get reports, one after another, from one woman after another, and that Melotti has been the individual who has done this, and also from Charles, your host, that he was the individual who trained the hosts and directed everybody else to run around and abuse people's rights in this regard, no?
No.
So he's not the person who gave you, who gave out instructions around this?
Not at all, no. Charles is in no way, shape, or form in a position of authority.
No. Officer Melotti was the individual who did it according to Charles.
Oh.
That is why I'm concerned about Officer Melotti gave the hosts, in essence, this information and misinformation that holding a sign, you have to be standing up. So all you old folks who are arthritic, stand up and hold your signs and tremble, or else tremble before the majesty of Officer Melotti's $54 tickets.
He's never told me that. He's never made any reference to doing that to me.
I'm glad to hear that. Because apparently he had told Charles that.
I think that Charles misunderstood. I believe that.
Apparently Officer Melotti also misunderstood because he was repeatedly doing it to people in the last 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
So I haven't heard anything about the last few weeks.
It's a sticky situation. Some people.
If somebody did this to you outside your home and abused you in this way, you would go to court and get some kind of financial damages for it.
So,
but if you're a poor person, of course, you don't have that option. But I'm glad that there are people like you who are concerned to see this change.
I am very concerned because I live here. And I work here, and I want it to be a good place, and I'm pretty proud of it, you know.
I too, and I appreciate you giving us information. Anything else you want to add?
I'm sorry?
Anything you want to add for the free radio audience?
Oh, this is going on the radio?
Yes.
Wow. Well, let's see. Free radio audience. Be tolerant of one another, and allow each other to live in the way that you best feel you want to live.
It's a diverse community, and that's what we want it to remain. Thank you very much, Cindy.
Welcome. Thank you for giving me the opportunity. All right.
Thanks.
And that was a conversation with, I believe her name was Kathy, the host with the downtown host, Downtown Information Center. Some of us call them the downtown snitches. This was her last day. She gave her perspective on it. And, of course, I gave mine. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is the extended version of Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides, Civil Rights for the Poor in Santa Cruz. Next, we're going to have a relatively long interview, because we do have this extra time, with Berkeley attorney David Beauvais. Beauvais is defending, or has been defending, the Explicit Players. These are a group of performers who perform naked in public and have been taken to task for it by the Berkeley authorities. Let's dive right in.
Okay, it's December 1st, 1999, and it's about 1:30. We're talking to that man of Berkeley, David Beauvais, attorney at law. Hi, David.
Hi there.
David, you're a man who's defended numerous people in the past in civil rights cases, ranging from a man accused of drawing chalk on a sidewalk with a political message around the People's Park controversy in Berkeley, to another man accused of serving free food to the homeless in San Francisco.
Yes.
Your latest case, however, exposes more. Can you tell us about it?
Well, we're presently in a court trial in Berkeley with performers who were cited for violating Berkeley's anti-nudity ordinance.
So they were accused of giving the naked truth.
That's right. They're called the Explicit Players, and they've been performing in Berkeley for, 8 or 9 years, and in other places, too.
Is this some sort of pornographic gig that's corrupting the youth you're defending here?
Well, no, not at all. It's non-erotic nudity. It's nudity in performance and occasionally nudity as protest. It's the type of thing that the San Francisco mime troupe does.
So we're talking about limp clit stuff, that sort of thing?
Right.
I got you. So what happened? I understand there was some controversy a couple years ago. Berkeley only had a misdemeanor law against nude performing, which made it difficult to prosecute because you actually had to involve the people and a jury trial, so they changed it. So now you can just get some old fogey judge to rule without a jury on these issues under the new infraction code?
Well, what happened was the Berkeley City Council decided to amend the ordinance to make it an infraction or a misdemeanor at the discretion of the prosecutor. And they were very clear about why they were doing it. That is that they were unable to get convictions before juries under the ordinance. So the district attorney threw up his hands and said, well, I'm not going to handle these cases anymore because it's impossible to get convictions unless you change the ordinance so that we can have trials in front of judges, especially when free speech defenses would be asserted in these cases, he said.
Now, have you been involved in any of these previous trials?
No, this is the first one.
Can you give us, do you have sort of a sense of how these earlier trials went?
Well, what happened was a number of them were thrown out on technical grounds. And there was one particular case involving breast nudity where two women were accused of violating the ordinance. And during the voir dire of the prospective jurors, just about everyone said that they would have no problem, you know, seeing a person naked in a public place, even if their children were there.
Now, did they take off their blouses at this point, or did they decline to do that?
No, they didn't do that. They haven't, you know, tried to do any of that sort of thing in the courtroom.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that would be quite a statement for the jury to strip down. I think that would be one way of telling the judge and the legislators to, should we say, dive off a pier, preferably with.
Right. There's a lot of awareness around this because it's really clear to me that the citizens of the city of Berkeley are not offended by nudity by and large. I mean, there are a few people who are. But it's all anecdotal evidence that they base this ordinance on. It's based upon a few people being upset, including one member of the city council at that time who was the prime inspiration behind passing the ordinance in the first place back in 1993. So Berkeley's really one of the few places where it's illegal to be nude in public. It's legal unless there's an ordinance that prohibits it. And the only time that nudity becomes a problem in a public place is if there's some sexual innuendo attached to it. If there's an intent to arouse or gratify or something like that, then you're getting into violation of the penal code. You know, it's a state law. But this particular, you know, situation involves just a city ordinance, which violation is an infraction, and we've been in trial for 4 days.
Now, how many people are you defending in this case?
Well, there's two lawyers involved. Bill Simpich and I are both representing the defendants. There's two defendants. The case started out with three defendants, but one of them was acquitted because the police officer did not make an identification in court. In fact, pointed to one of the other defendants as being the one who was at that particular event that he wasn't even charged with.
And who are these three defendants?
Marty Kent, Debbie Moore, and John Lancidal.
Two men and one woman?
Right. And John Lancidal is the one who was dismissed.
Mm-hmm. Now, I take it Debbie and what's the other fellow's name?
Marty Kent.
And Marty have been showing up with all their clothes on.
Yes, they have.
They caused a stir in city council, I understand, by showing up without their usual clothes.
I'm not sure that ever happened. I know that there was another person who became famous as the naked guy who went to a city council meeting and addressed the meeting naked.
Andrew, that's right.
And that was really the catalyst for passing the ordinance.
This is a man of non-Caucasian disposition who is, he's been hitchhiking. I caught him when he had clothes on coming from San Francisco to Berkeley at one point. Andrew
Martinez.
That's the one. Anyway, for 4 days, you've been... 4 days. How many hours a day in court are we talking about?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't really kept track of it. But but generally we've had, well, we've had 3 days of trials so far. We had a number of days of pretrial motions, and then we had 3 days of trial, and now Monday we go back for the fourth day of trial.
What is taking so long? That's certainly for an infraction case, it sounds unheard of.
Well, it's difficult because of the First Amendment issues involved in the case. Makes it very complex and basically requires that evidence be produced as to why the nudity is so important to the First Amendment protected speech involved in what they're doing. They're performers, and performance by definition is speech. The question is whether the nudity is so intertwined with the message that's intended to be conveyed that it's protected, because nudity in and of itself is not protected under the First Amendment, but nudity coupled with other expression in which nudity is an essential feature of that expression becomes protected. So we have to be able to show that the nudity was conveying a message together with the rest of the performance.
Well, what message was? What were these naked armpits conveying anyway?
Well, I think that's a very complex message, and it involves a number of dimensions. But I think to sum it up, I would say that the message is that we have become so estranged from our own natures. We've built up this cultural illusion that we walk through every day in the street, and we put on our armor and we go out and we get in our cars, and we're more or less oblivious to the connections with other people. And the nudity, I think, is a softening of the street scene in a way, and that's part of what's being conveyed there.
Sort of you're without your armor, you're without the armor of your clothing.
Right.
You're without the kind of concealing devices, the shields that you normally have.
That's right. That's right. And vulnerability is part of that message. And opening up and making connections with others in the street, not in a theater where people are expecting to be entertained, but in a public place where the context of this is so jarring that you begin to reflect upon what is this really about and who are we? And, you know, it's that kind of a message that I think is so powerful. It can't really be expressed any other way.
Have you had a lot of witnesses on either side in this trial?
Well, there have been mostly defense witnesses. We've had two police officers who said, yes, I saw them in a public place, and yes, they were naked. And in one instance, they were protesting the cutting down of over 200 trees downtown Berkeley. And
did they successfully protest, or did the cutting continue?
Actually, it resulted in a compromise in which about 100 of the trees were saved. And there were people involved in organizing that protest who felt that the participation of people who were naked was a really beneficial and significant part of the victory that they achieved in that situation.
Well, I know that
they were able to bring more attention to the issue than if they had been there, you know, with their clothes on protesting in the more conventional way.
Well, I know that over in San Francisco a month and a half ago, Helen Caldicott, in a protest against nuclear weapons, led a whole bunch of ordinary, middle-class, middle-aged people onto the streets of San Francisco on Van Ness Avenue naked.
Yes, yes, she did. I was going to mention that, too, because I think that happened in the midst of all of this. And that fortifies what our position is that can be such a powerful way to bring home a message, particularly when the media is ignoring the message. So it's a way of bringing and drawing attention to something that it wouldn't otherwise be dealt with in a way that creates a debate.
Is the media ignoring your message at the moment, or is it covering your trial?
Well, we get some spotty coverage. We've had some of the newspapers take the position that they don't want to really say anything about this case until there's a result. So we've had most of the major area newspapers there. We've had the Oakland Tribune, the Chronicle, Contra Costa Times, the Daily Californian, which is the affiliated with the school, the University of California.
Berkeley Daily Planet, the new...
And the Daily Planet has been... Daily Planet's been giving us quite a bit of coverage. They cover the trial every day, and they report on it every day that it happens.
Has this trial
had an impact on cutting back the performance activities of the explicit players?
Well, I don't really know whether that's true. There have been times when they've performed, notwithstanding these charges, and even while charges were pending in the first case, the first event, the tree protest, they performed again while that case was pending. So I'd have to say it's not much of a deterrent.
Now, so were they...
What's interesting is that they did perform in the How Berkeley Can You Be parade, basically a parade that's at least partly funded by the city, and they were used in the promotional materials for the parade.
Naked or clothed?
Well, they were advertised as the explicit players who would be in the parade.
I see. So
we have a quasi-official parade the day before our trial in which they perform naked with the sanction of the city of Berkeley. With a very large turnout and a rather heavy police presence and no arrests.
Well, let me ask you, what does an explicit player's performance consist of? Give us a kind of a description.
Well, they are to some degree spontaneous or impromptu, I guess is the word, but they're also partly choreographed and they're planned in advance, and it consists of music and poetry, didgeridoo playing, bells, props such as wings and signs. These were all elements that were involved in the two cases where they were arrested that we're now on trial for. And I think the high point in the trial was when Deb Moore was on the stand and played a didgeridoo for the court.
A didgeridoo is sort of a long wind instrument?
Yes.
And what? Tell us more about that high point.
Well, she was describing, you know, some of the elements of the performance, including the didgeridoo, and she had her didgeridoo with her as she was testifying, and she described the kind of sound that it makes and how it adds to the performance, and I asked her to play it. She played it from the stand.
and the judge is, what's the name of the judge?
Ron Greenberg.
And what's your impression of him? Is he a liberal judge? Any predictions?
He's a very thoughtful judge. I would prefer to have had a jury because I think this is the kind of case that's really one that tests what the community standards are in Berkeley. And I don't want to preordain a result because I have no idea what's going to happen.
I think what you should have done.
I also get the feeling that he's given this case a lot of thought, consideration, and we still wish we had a jury because we think that juries really should be deciding.
Well, I think what you should do is have your own voir dire process out in the corridor, impanel a jury, and have them sit in the audience, and then they can make up their minds. Just a thought.
What a wonderful idea.
That's a great plan. Of course,
a little late for that.
A little late in the game. But maybe you can have a sort of a token jury or a miniature jury.
Well, if there's a next time, maybe we could do that.
And the jury could be either naked or clothed, depending on their sentiments.
Right.
Or perhaps half clothed. So what's the possible sentence for this crime if they're found guilty?
I think that the courtesy notices they got in the mail from the court said pay a fine of $130 or show up on such and such a date.
Now, are you doing this pro bono or are you charging for it?
I don't think that's particularly relevant.
What I'm saying is that for an average person who is, you know, charged with this crime, is it more expensive for that person to go to trial or to pay the fine?
Well, it's obviously more expensive to go to trial. I mean, even if you had a free attorney doing it, you would the time that it would take.
How much time would you estimate this kind of a case would take? I mean, you're now an expert at it.
Well, we've been in trial for 3 days. There was a lot of planning involved. There were motions before trial. There's complex legal issues out of what would seem to be, you know, a relatively simple and straightforward case, but it's hardly that at all. We've had expert witnesses that we've brought in to testify.
50 to 100 hours, maybe?
Probably.
And if you consider, I mean, we have an attorney here who works for minimum wage in a homeless case. And that's, I think it's $6.75 an hour, $7 an hour he's doing it. And even that, even in that sort of a situation, we're talking $350 to $700, more than, what, 3.5 to 7 times the ticket cost. So this is really a matter of principle for these people, right?
Well, yeah, it really is. And what we want to establish is their right to perform and not be pushed into a theater, which is what the ordinance allows.
Now, if they lose this, and let's say they say, well, I'm sorry, the Constitution is a higher law than this local city ordinance, the needs of the community to be freed from their fears about nudity and for this message to be able to come through is more important than, you know, this kind of a fine. Do they simply face a similar fine again, or do they face worse charges if they repeat their performance?
Well, I mean, as a practical matter, since the district attorney isn't going to prosecute them for a misdemeanor, if they do it again, then they'd probably be charged with an infraction again.
So theoretically, they could try to pass the hat to pay the fine with every performance.
Well, they could.
I mean, assuming that the decision goes against you, it's just one of my thoughts.
Right, that's certainly, you know, something to look at, and I think that they have passed the hat probably at times, but I'm not really sure of that. Mm-hmm. But it's an option.
Has the prosecution brought forward any expert testimony, let's say, that this kind of nudity is deleterious to the mental health or development of minors?
No, that's the next big issue. We're contending that they have to come forward with some evidence that there's some harm here, or that there's a significant state interest in regulating and prohibiting public nudity in performance. And we don't think they're going to be able to make that showing. So, and the question will then become whether the judge feels that they're required to do it by law. We know that under the federal constitutional principles, the court looks at how significant their interest is and also looks at whether there's any alternative means by which they can express themselves. And, of course, the city's argument is that they can express themselves in a theater. But I think that we've produced evidence to show that that's not an adequate alternative because it's not the audience they intend to reach.
How about the audience for the trial? Has there been a lot of public interest in this trial? Has the courtroom been filled? Or?
We've had quite a few people come by. You know, everybody has their lives, and so it's hard for people to make it all the time. But in the aggregate, it looks like a lot of people have come by, at least for short periods of time, to check in on the trial. I'm really happy about that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, are the explicit players booked for the weeks ahead? Are they planning to continue their performances, as far as you know?
I'm not too sure about that because I have my head so much in the developing the testimony in this case and doing the legal work that I'm not too much up on what they're doing outside of this case. I'm not aware of any performances right now that are going on, but this is also the time of year when they tend to cut back anyway because of the winter months and so forth.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about a trial that's taken 3 days so far, just not counting the pretrial motions?
Right, not counting the pretrial motions.
Like 4 hours a day in trial, more or less? Or?
Well, no, we've had full days.
Like 6 or 7 hours a day?
Yeah, uh-huh.
And so is this, I mean, I've been to over 100 infraction trials, I would imagine, here in Santa Cruz. They usually last sometimes they last as short as 2 or 3 minutes. I think the longest one I've ever seen is maybe a couple of hours. You're talking a huge, long trial. Of course, we are talking about 2 defendants, previously 3 defendants.
Oh, this may turn out to be the longest infraction trial in California history, for all we know.
Wow. So you've got the...
I never have had or been involved in an infraction case that was this, this long.
How does it feel to you? Is it exciting? Is it tedious? Is it exhausting? Is it all these things? How are you feeling as a lawyer?
Oh, I'm enjoying myself immensely. I'm really having a good time.
And are you getting much community support? Are people, you know, donating to the cause here? I mean, is any of that?
Well, we haven't done that. I mean, we haven't. We've tried to get the word out as much as we could about this case is here. But there hasn't really, as far as I know, been much of an effort to raise money.
And, of course, I assume on the final day of the case, in solidarity with your defendants, you will, of course, strip down to your birthday suit.
No, this would not be good, because I have to maintain some sense of objectivity about the situation.
Well, solidarity or objectivity, the perennial dilemma of
the movement. Yes, it is.
Well, any issues that have come up over the last 3 or 4 days you think that are particularly interesting that may not have been covered by the mainstream media? Not much of it has been covered here in Santa Cruz. We've heard. I think I've seen a little blurb in the Examiner that there was a trial in progress. Your name was not mentioned, but I assume it had to be some scallywag attorney.
Good thing, huh?
Yes. And so, I mean, you mentioned First Amendment issues. Anything you know that you want us to kind of bring up specifically for the legal buffs that you think they might be interested in knowing has been covered in this trial?
Well, we raised a number of issues. First of all, the threshold issue for me was the amendment.
You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is your host, Bathrobe's Bear Robert, taking a lunch break. You're listening to an interview from early December with attorney David Beauvais of Berkeley about his defending the explicit players in trial. This interview continues.
Okay, hang on just a second.
They're getting, Don was there, and they're compiling a packet for the whole committee because it needs to go.
Looks like the mayor got into the act there. We have a little tape switching to do here, but we will do it shortly. In the meantime, a brief musical interlude. Stay with us.
Born in West Virginia, here all my life. 16 years a miner's daughter, then a miner's wife. Raised in Logan County when the creeks fell ran clear. And Buffalo Holler's been my home for more than 50 years. I remember when Stavisky came. One they call the foe, and the Johnsons up from Georgia, their skin's black as coal. Even the Italians came because the mines were here. They've been my friends in Buffalo Creek for more than 50 years. Hunger took my baby girl in 1941. Black Lung took my husband, the army took my son. But of all the sorrows I have seen, the worst time I have known was the day the towns were washed away when the old dog mill came down. If your home was down the creek, you had time to get away. But if you lived up by the dam, you had barely time to pray. It only took 1 hour on the water roaring through to wipe out everything I had, most everyone I knew. In 65 they warned us, nobody made a will. But all the folks with money moved high up on the hill. It was only poor coal miners that died that Saturday. And they can get plenty more like us most any working day. Experts said the dam would go if we had a heavy rain. The Bureau of Mines wrote it down. person call it an act of God. I call it an act of man. Don't wait for compensation. Don't wait for them to care. If you can't make that dollar sign, they just don't know you're there. But I can't forget my Billy, who died in Vietnam, fighting for the system that made the old slave down.
In this case, was the amendment of the ordinance to allow the district attorney to charge these cases as misdemeanors, as infractions.
So previously it was an automatic misdemeanor which allowed the defense a jury trial and presumably an appointed public defender, right?
That's right. And with this change, of course, they're denied both of those. And we felt that since the motivation for the ordinance amendment was to deprive a particular group of people of a jury trial, that this was an impermissible amendment.
And what was the response of the judge to that argument?
Well, he rejected the argument.
On what grounds?
Not particularly clear to me, actually.
The DA, the city council can do what it wants, that sort of thing, or legislative power, or...
Something like that. I mean, I really can't explain in a very clear way exactly what the thinking was.
Well, certainly, you know, the argument could be made that, are you saying that any time something is made a leaner, that is something could be either an infraction or a misdemeanor, that the defense can respond, oh, you're just trying to deny people their jury trials? I mean, that was an argument could be used for all categories of cases. You must have had a further argument that said, no, this is true in this specific case for the following reasons, right?
Right. Well, there was never any question about the motivation. I mean, the city council never said, we want to ameliorate the punishment for this because we think it's too harsh and people really shouldn't go to jail for this.
And so it would make it an infraction.
Or at least the district attorney should have the power to decide that in a particular case, they want to treat them more leniently than in other cases. For example, let's suppose it's a first offender or something like that, and they really don't want to expose that person to misdemeanor prosecution. That would be a legitimate reason to amend the ordinance.
But instead they said, we aren't...
That was, if people are going to be making challenges to this ordinance or its application based on First Amendment, then we want to be able to have these handled by the courts and not handled by, and not have juries involved.
Are they saying that they're legal issues that are better dealt with by judges than juries?
That was the argument, that people are not sophisticated enough to deal with the issues.
Maybe it's that people are not bigoted enough to essentially rule for,
right,
you know, against the First Amendment and against the explicit players in similar groups, and that we want to appeal to appointed judges who actually, I assume, judges have more ties to the existing political and judicial system and are more likely to be beholden
to
politicians, you know?
That's right.
So, I mean, that seems to me to be a way of, like, prejudicing the jury pool where the jury becomes the judge.
Right.
So that was your first argument. It was struck down by Judge Greenberg. Is that his name?
Right.
And what other arguments did you present that you think were pertinent or interesting for us to know about?
Well, after the prosecution presented their case, and we began to move into our case, we started to get objections that we're not allowed to present a First Amendment defense at all because we should have raised that issue before trial, and that it's not a timely... we had waived the issue, in other words, by not making a pretrial motion.
Uh-huh.
Deal with the First Amendment issues.
What did the judge say?
Well, the judge took that under submission and then came back and ruled that we could present it at the trial, and we presented pretrial.
So have any issues? Have we been talking mostly in the last 3 days about legal issues, or have you been talking about other issues?
Well, the legal issues are interspersed with the other issues in the case. they sometimes come up in the middle of testimony, or they come up at various conference.
Let's say for the last
meetings,
last day of the trial. What have you guys been talking about in the court? Is it?
Well, the last day of trial, we were basically just putting on evidence.
And what kind of evidence are we talking about?
Well, Debbie Moore testified most of the day. We had a few other witnesses who were there for the two events that occurred, and the other witnesses basically, you know, testified to what they saw.
What did Debbie testify? What kinds of things did she say?
Well, she testified to what the events were on the two occasions. She testified to why it was important to make these expressions in the places where they were made, and why they couldn't be made anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about two events, one being the protest for the trees, and the other being?
An event that occurred in People's Park. It was a Lupercalia.
Which is?
An old Roman festival.
Is this some sort of sexually licentious festival?
Well, there was some question about that, because the Roman festival, I think, did have some sexual component to it, but it's not necessarily a sexual performance, and so this one certainly wasn't.
Well, was there any fucking going on?
No, nothing like that.
What was the pity? Well, so this trial should be proceeding to another, next Monday it should be resuming in what department?
It's in Department 203.
Where is that?
2000 Center Street, Berkeley, second floor.
At what time?
9 o'clock.
So for all you early brewers in Santa Cruz, you know, jump into your car.
And actually, the trial has concluded by this time, although the ruling is not in.
Suggestive behavior, right?
That's right.
If you want to get a date with Debbie, you'll have to do it on the strength of your intellect and your aesthetic power.
There you go.
What about a date with you, David?
I'm sorry?
What about a date with you?
Available right now.
Well, there you have it. Forget the trip, folks. But certainly stay tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz here at 96.3 for the results. You will give us a call and let us know whether the much-feared fines are coming down or whether the judge has seen the light.
Sure.
Is this going to have an impact in the future, or will the DAs and the police simply move in, ticket again, and go to another judge?
That's a big question. That's a good question, and we don't know the answer because we don't have a crystal ball. But I would think that it would have some effect on making the cops think twice before they did it.
How often do they go after people for nudity in Berkeley? I guess the question I have is, have there been other cases that you may not have heard about where people have been, you probably not have heard about them, but where people get ticketed for nudity of one sort or another and they simply quietly pay their fines? I mean, do we know anything about this?
I don't really know how often. I don't think there are too many cases.
Well, I'll have to sort of let it all hang out when I come to Berkeley and see what they say about me.
Good enough.
Perhaps we could try to, enmesh you as a sympathetic, low-income attorney.
There you go.
Perhaps a no-income attorney. Anything you want to add on this case, David Beauvais, a Berkeley attorney?
No.
Well, you've done a fine job, and we appreciate your taking the time.
Okay, well, you take care.
And that's the ongoing case of the explicit players in Berkeley. A final decision is due in January, and we're also going to do an update on this case at the next session of Bathrob Spears Broadsides, this Civil Rights for the Poor show, poor of clothing and poor of money. That's going to be on Thursday at 6 o'clock, running till 8 in the evening, if you want to join the next edition. We still have another hour to go on this edition, thanks to the cancellation of the Little Red Hen show, and I hope the Little Red Hens are doing okay. They should feel free to call in and do a little clucking if they wish. But their show will be resuming, I presume, next week, next Sunday at the same time, 1:30 to 3. They're hors de combat for the moment. And that gives us a chance to
fill out the Bathroom Spears broadside show and get the tapes we haven't been able to play played, or at least some of them. Here's a tape from Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, recorded, I guess it was within the last week. At that time, Christmas season being in full swing, a few days before Christmas, the police were doing their usual harassment activities of homeless people, or what I guess are frequent harassment activities up there on Telegraph Avenue, and we caught a little bit on tape.
Okay, well, it's about 10 after 12. We're on Telegraph Avenue here in Berkeley on December 22nd, talking to Willow. And Willow, you're here in front of Cody's bookshop. You're with your pooch. What's the name of the pooch?
Yumaya.
And you have a friend here with you?
Yeah, Eric.
And you have, your backpack and a cup of coffee. Now, a moment ago, a number of police officers, I guess two of them, approached you, and what did they say?
They said it's time to move along. You're on private property, so you're going to have to get up and go. And then they just said thank you and left.
I see. Now, we just heard from Russell Bates, who has a stand here which sells bumper stickers and so forth in front of Cody's bookshop, that in fact is not an accurate interpretation of the law. Is that right?
Right. That is right, because we sit here all the time. And now Russell's telling him about it, and they're like pointing out to him some sort of like little border that's like right here that we can't sit on.
Right.
But if we moved over there, they would say the same thing. Cody's doesn't even have an awareness that we're here. They're just using that,
Are you a person without a lodging indoors?
Right, and so they're aware of that, and they just like to mess with people.
How long have you been outdoors?
A long, long time. 20 years, 15
and
years.
Are you local to Berkeley, pretty much?
Yeah, and they know it, and they just like to do little things to mess with me.
And so this happened to you before?
All the time.
The last time it happened before this morning was?
Last night.
And where were you there?
Right across the street over there with a bunch of people.
And what happened?
Oh, my friend had a lot of her stuff in a cart. And so they came over and they said that you can't have this much stuff. So I had talked to Cop Watch and I was like, what do you mean there's no like limit to how much belongings you can have and this and that. And then they started like saying, no, let's check and see if you have any warrants and like using all this.
You know the name of the officer who was doing this?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. One of them is Officer Moore.
And how many officers were involved in this stop last night?
Like about five.
About what time was it?
About 8, 7:30, 8 o'clock. And they ended up telling my friend that she needed to move her shopping cart because it looks like an encampment. And because there were a couple, like, just like little backpacks, and then she had her cart there. And I was like, this is nonsense. You can't, like, tell her that she has to move her stuff. We had no complaints. In fact, one of the people from Mario's had bought soup and brought it out and, like, fed everybody. And there was, like, no problems at all. And they just used it as an arbitrary, way to come up and like, because they didn't want to see it there.
Let me continue talking to you, but first let me keep an eye on Russell's stand here.
Yeah.
So, I know there was a controversy last summer where the city council tried to make it illegal to sit on the sidewalk again, and they failed. But they're still harassing people in front of Cody's for sitting on the sidewalk.
Like here and across the street by Mario's, anywhere, like downtown, right here.
Therefore, Russell Bates, you spoke to the police officer. What did you learn?
Yeah, well, according to the cops, the planters outside of Cody's are public property, private property. Therefore, he can make distinctions as far as who can sit there. For instance, his employees on... thank you very much. His employees can sit there because he has given them permission to sit there. Other people are denied permission because Andy Ross says that they can't sit there. Even though, according to this sheet put out by Ocean Newman, you can't trespass on a public sidewalk or area open to the public, such as the plaza in front of Cody's, no matter who technically owns it. If the area has been open to the public for pedestrian use, the owner of the property can't forbid people from sitting on it, as long as they're not intentionally blocking other people.
Mm-hmm. Well, we weren't even sitting on the planters. We were like away from, we're sitting right there and blocking no one and not even near the planters, so it's nonsense.
So you weren't on the planters?
No. Not until just now when I was speaking with you.
There's some harassment going on. I'm gonna follow
that. That's the same woman.
I'll be back. So we're walking across the street. We see these same three police officers speaking across on Hayes next to La Fiesta restaurant to an individual with a shopping cart. And check this out.
Not asking anybody. Are out here last week. They're just having trouble getting into the shelters and have mental health, see what they can do. Not all police contacts are happening.
That's good.
Right?
Now, is it true that these officers told this couple to move even though they were not sitting on planters and were simply sitting near planters in front of Cody's?
I have no idea what they told them. I wasn't there.
Were you one of the officers?
Yes, I was.
So what happened? What was the problem, officer?
I explained it to Russell here. If you draw a line, Cody's building extends. You know the curved part of Cody's glass, the curved part where the children's section is? Are you familiar with that?
Mm-hmm.
If you draw a line from the furthest point that sticks out, I don't know if you can understand this, but if you draw a line basically that parallels the curb,
right,
that is all Cody's property.
Right.
And it extends a little past the planter. So even though the planters in the area directly in front of the planters look like public property, it looks like a sidewalk, mm-hmm, it actually isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And we've asked people that are sitting there, unless they're specifically Cody's employees, which are allowed to sit there, that they just move along. And the thing is, we don't issue citations unless it's a chronic problem. She's actually a very nice person. We just asked her if she could find some of the places to sit so it doesn't become an issue.
So, obviously, your name is Pierre Antoni.
Uh-huh.
And so you take issue then with, I guess, the reading of Osha Newman and Russell Bates that if an area is open to public pedestrian traffic, that it can't really be closed off, even if it is technically Cody's property.
Closed off?
Well, that is to say, you cannot state we only are going to allow selected people to use that area if it's open to the general public. That's the claim. He showed you the. Did he show you the literature?
And how I tried to relate it. And have you ever been to downtown San Francisco?
I have.
You know how they have some like plazas in front of large high-rise buildings where it is private property, but they make it kind of a sitting space off of the sidewalk, where you go off of the sidewalk. It's very open, sort of. You know, it looks like public space, and you go on this little sitting plaza and sit there and you eat lunch.
Right.
It looks like it's open public space, but it actually is private space, and suddenly whoever owns that space says, well, you know, I'm only going to allow certain people to sit here, say employees of the building or tenants of the building.
Mm-hmm.
He can request the officers, since technically trespassing, even though it's not a high priority issue,
mm-hmm,
that we ask, or if they say, you know, they ask as a private citizen, could you guys move along? They go, forget it, this is public property, we're going to hang out here.
Right.
Then an officer goes by, officer, could you please just warn that person? We go and say, please, we explain to him, it's private property, could you please move along and find some other place to sit? This is actually, a lot of people have a misconception that it's public property. It actually is not public property.
Right. No,
it looks very open to the sidewalk.
I understand.
It actually has the same design as the sidewalk.
Actually, I believe they agree with you. It's private property technically, but the claim is that because it's open to public use, I guess Attorney Newman claims that it is accessible to people. And you dispute that interpretation.
I am not an attorney.
Right.
I am not. I can't make.
Well, I'm
judge. That's what I've been ordered to do.
Those are your orders.
Those are my orders.
Well, let me ask you one more question. An issue in Berkeley is the places for homeless people to sleep. I'm sure you know there aren't enough places for folks to sleep.
I think that's the problem other than Berkeley.
It's a problem across the country.
Yeah.
My question to you is, and because we are in Berkeley,
sure,
and you, of course, are charged with peace and safety here in Berkeley.
Uh-huh.
What's the technical reality of a person sleeping in a vehicle? Are they violating a code if they're parked on a street sleeping in a vehicle?
To be honest, I know there is a no house cars in Berkeley. I don't know what house car is supposed to be interpreted to mean. Is that a motorhome? Is that somebody with a camper shell like this pickup truck right here? I don't know.
How about a person in their own car just sleeping? Just an ordinary car.
I would not know. To be honest, if somebody had complained about that and I walked up and there was just a person sleeping in their car, I would call the supervisor to help me figure out if that was a crime. If that.
Thank you. Right. So we came up upon you. Your name is?
Jennifer Beckman.
Jennifer, you're here, of course, next to the Fiesta restaurant. I just got a long explanation from Officer, I guess, Pierre, the officer I just spoke with. And his sergeant initially claimed they were just giving you information about services that you could access, shelter services. Is this what they were doing?
No.
What were they doing?
Actually, they want to move me off the avenue.
Okay, I'm sorry. You were saying?
They want to move me off the avenue because I'm a street person, and they don't switch over street people. They came and asked me about the shopping cart I have.
What did they ask you?
Well, they wanted to know where I got it.
It says Berkeley Bowl Marketplace.
Right.
You're under arrest. Take her into custody.
No, it wasn't quite like that. They said they were concerned that I might have stolen it. And I just
you look like a pretty shifty character.
Yeah, I am. Yeah, I'm 53. I used to be a secretary.
You haven't quite gotten away with the cart. You made it this far in your getaway.
Yeah.
You're pausing for breath.
So anyway, I explained I did not steal the cart, and they said, why don't I go down to Shattuck? Because down there,
They wouldn't hassle me. Up here, they will.
They use the word hassle?
No, they didn't say hassle, but down here, up here, they won't. Down there, they won't approach me and tell me to move or leave. Or it's okay to have my body down there. But
did you show them the star on your shoulder and ask if that was the Jewish ghetto down on the Shadow?
No, I didn't. I didn't do that. But I did have to show them my ID. And they did check me out, and I did explain that I didn't have any arrest record, and I didn't even have so much as a ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the second or third time they've done this to me.
In what period of time?
About a week and a half.
Same officers or different officers?
Different ones.
And do you think this, is this, how long have you been on Telegraph Avenue?
A couple of weeks, I think. Yeah, about 2.5 weeks.
Has there been an intensification of police pressure against street people?
Undoubtedly. Undoubtedly. I mean, there was one girl that came up. We were standing here one night. There was one girl that came up, and she says, I just got a ticket for littering. She says, what happened was I picked the paper up off the ground and put it back down, and they gave me a ticket for littering. Can you believe it?
The criminal groups you hang out with, you know, they're pretty shifty, as I said.
Yeah. I thought, my God, you know, what? You know, how come you're not ticketing the guy who's the paper bag lifted up on his leg and he threw it out in the street, you know? It's just insane. It's ridiculous.
Is this going to serve to drive you from Telegraph, or do you think you're going to remain up here?
I'm going to remain up here.
So in other words, you anticipate further harassment?
I anticipate they may further harass me, but I haven't broken any laws.
Huh?
I haven't broken a single law.
Yeah, but I mean, look at this. We need more upscale clothing. What about some Birkenstocks? And I mean,
oh, that's right. Yeah, my clothes and my offensive card.
How are people going to, you know, want to come down to Telegraph if people like yourself constantly clutter up the avenue?
It's your bedding.
I really
your
think
fluttering.
My bedding is fluttering. Yeah. Well, originally they came up to me and said something about the fact that the cart. Oh, last night they came up, as a matter of fact, and said that complaints had been received and that they were possibly going to have to ask us to move on. And I said, complaints about my cart? And they said, no. But then he went on into a long explanation about how I should be in a shelter and all this, and how come I wasn't in the shelter. I don't want to go in at 7 o'clock, like I'm a kid.
What are the shelter rules in Berkeley? Give us a kind of a...
I don't know, because I haven't been in one yet, but I know that you have to be there at a certain time. You have to check in at a certain time, and you have to be responsible for your own belongings, and you have to stay there. At, you know, 7 to 7:30, and you have to stay there. I want to be out. I'm a human being. I'm alive. I'm an adult.
Well, that's certainly a radical view, I must say. So you sleep out on the street pretty much, or where do you sleep?
I have so far. I have slept on the street.
Have you gotten a ticket for sleeping out?
No, I haven't yet.
Have police officers passed you by, seen you, and moved along?
Yes. Police officers have passed by, seen me, and moved
along. Up on Telegraph?
Well, but you see, I wasn't sleeping. I was awake. And what I do is I half manage to get about 3 hours of sleep, maybe 2.5, 3 hours of sleep, by sleeping in a ladies' room. And then I come out and I sit on a concrete bench, and I just sit up a lot.
And, I'm without words at the moment, but is there a law against sleeping outside on the public sidewalk in Berkeley, as far as you know?
Not as far as I know. I know some people may have done it, but I think I have seen only one person on Telegraph Avenue at night, and otherwise, I think they do come and hassle you about it.
So you're suggesting you don't know if there's a law. And in fact, I wasn't able to ask the police officer. He talked about sleeping in your vehicle, and that being, he didn't know whether that was illegal or not. One would have thought that after a certain amount of time on the force, he would come up with an answer to that one, but he didn't know.
Well, they won't tell you what the laws are. They will tell you this, that, and the other thing. You should be in the shelter. This, you know, you have to be able to pick up your... Well, the reason I got the shopping cart, which they said they were concerned I stole, which I didn't. The reason I got it was I had originally had my stuff stored in a shop, regular little shopping cart. And
a non-commercial shopping cart?
A non-commercial shopping cart. And it fell apart. I mean, it literally disintegrated. So then I went out, and I was trying to make it look neat. It was in just bags all over the place. I was trying to make it look neat. So one day I'm out here, I go and get all these boxes. I start folding out my clothes, putting them in the boxes. I stack up the boxes. It looks really neat. About, within a short period of time, 15, 20 minutes later, a cop comes along and he says, "That's too much. That's too much belonging. It looks like you're camping out here. You'll have to... You can only have as much as you can pick up and carry with you at one time in case we have to move you off, in case we tell you to move along."
When was this?
2 days
ago.
2-3 days ago.
Uh-huh.
So, what do you mean?
Actually, that was the officer you were just talking to that warned her that...
You were a witness to it?
Yeah.
Your name is?
Eric.
Okay.
So, anyway, he says you have to have... "Oh, honey, I'm sorry." He said you can only have enough that you can pick up and carry off with you in one movement. You know, he said, "Well, how much, you know, do you have there? Could you pick up and carry all that with you at one time?" I said, "Well, no, I could do it in two trips." "Well, you have to do it in one." So I said, "Fine."
That's against the law. Cop told me that's arbitrary. That's nonsense. They can't do that. There's a law against that.
They can't legally.
They want us to, like, write all of this down and start documenting it and everything so that they can get rid of Boga, because he's, like, the major...
The name of the officer again is...
Boga.
How do you spell it?
B-O-G-A.
B-O-G-A, I think.
We call him Booger, but I don't know.
So you were saying... your name again is...
Jennifer Beckman.
You're saying, Jennifer, that you... This was the history of how you got the shopping cart. So there you were told you couldn't have more boxes than you could carry,
right.
And so what happened next?
So I went down to Danny's place where he stays, and there was a shopping cart there that Danny told me I could use. I don't know where he got it or where, how it happened to be there, but he told me I could use it. So I took out the little bit of stuff that was in there, called it back up here, put all my stuff in it, and they apparently don't like that. So now
it's really hard to please those guys in blue. They're very picky.
Yeah. So it's three times in the last 3 days that I have been told, go to a shelter, get off the avenue.
Now, what's the story with shelters? You may know more about this, and your name again is?
Willow.
What's the story? Why aren't you in a shelter, Willow?
Because I don't want to go in a shelter.
And why is that?
I have a dog, and there's no place for dogs except San Francisco downtown in this, like, slummy place. Like, really sleazy, from what I hear, where you get your animals welcome with you. But I'm not going to go all the way, try to transport myself all the way to the city to live there with my dog. I mean, that's like...
Is that the only reason that people are avoiding... Let me put it this way. Are
people with animals?
How about other women? Do most women go to shelters, or is there shelter space for everyone in Berkeley?
My feeling is, talking to people, that nobody wants to stay into shelters because they're just nasty. They're like... really.
I mean, they're afraid to sleep out. If you're a woman, you're afraid to sleep out. And you're also afraid you're going to be hassled by the police.
And then once you get stuck in a place like that, then you know, it's like a dead-end thing. And then they end up telling you, well, time's up, you got to go. And then you become, like, institutionalized or something. The women that I've talked to have said that they just really don't like it because it's like being in jail. Get your things stolen from other, like...
You can't crack
and blah, 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 blah.
There's no storage space. You can't take your things there. You can't sleep while your things are there because somebody gets up in the middle of the night and rips you off. I mean, why would you want to go?
What about violence in Berkeley? Have homeless people been beaten up much in the last month that you know of?
Not that I've noticed. There's, like, a group of people that look out for each other. There isn't, like, too much problems with that, but...
I saw something in the Berkeley Voice, a little article about a homeless man being hit with a brick or something.
Oh, that occasionally does happen, I think.
Anything else you want to say to Free Radio Santa Cruz, Willow or Jennifer?
Yeah, keep up the work.
There is no way you're going to get rid of the homeless. Cost us some money.
Eric?
There's nothing.
And I'm safe, I mean.
Sure.
I don't want to be yet.
So it's about... 1 o'clock, a little thereafter, we're at the Med Cafe sidewalk section talking to poet Julia Vinograd. Hi, Julia.
Hi.
I should say, talking to social and political commentator Julia Vinograd. Julia, you not only have written a new book, Ask a Mask, which you are displaying here, without a business license, I might add, shocking, and bubbling, boy, interfering with the public passageways. But in addition to that, you made some comments about the San Francisco election about how Supervisor Tom Ammiano, president of the Board of Supervisors, and upset winner of the runoff, or at least one of the two winners of the runoff, could have actually won the final election. Andy Cummison.
Well, he should have concentrated on the real issue instead of just flapping around about little businesses in the neighborhood. What that actually means is rent, as in rent, as in rent. And that's one thing that all constituencies agree on, except for the very rich. Brown was talking about how he was building houses for middle-income people to buy, but nine-tenths of San Francisco rents, and a lot of the minority people who voted for Brown out of loyalty, you vote for your own, they're renters. And what the landlords are doing to tenants in San Francisco is not to be believed, that Ellis Act. And Brown, anybody else but Brown, could have claimed that, well, I can't touch it, it was passed by somebody else. Brown can touch anything. He's the original shark and conniver. And now that there's been some publicity on the Ellis Act, and Ammiano got that thing to the Board of Supervisors, Brown is signing it, but Ammiano could have won that election if instead of just getting up there and, it's going to be the 60s again, he could have said, is your landlord raising your rent? Are you about to be evicted? Everybody would have come out and voted. I mean, that's not politics, that's survival.
Well, I know that Ammiano began to get more hardline and Jordan Brown Agnos sounding on homeless issues as they got closer to the final election. He talked about enforcing so-called quality of life matrix laws. He talked about letting people keep their shopping carts for 24 hours after getting a warning and maybe...
Yeah. I mean, if all you have is your shopping cart, what difference will 24 hours make? You either let them keep it or you take it away. And...
Well, I think, he slid on those issues. There's a lot of kind of glowing aftertalk. Some people are really disappointed. Others are saying, well, it certainly was better than any election in the last 20 years, at least.
Well, people did come out and vote. But most of the people who were fighting for Ammiano had more sense than he did. There was this absolutely wonderful button that summed up the whole thing, and that you never saw it on TV. With another terrified tenant for Tom.
I like it.
But why wasn't that kind of thing on TV? Why didn't he talk like that?
Well, shall we say weenie politics?
Okay. Some have weeniness thrust upon them. But, anyway, I'm just a sore loser, I guess. And I should probably be plugging my book at all.
Before we go on, you can go on as you wish, but Berkeley is also a city of tenants. What's happening with the tenants here in Berkeley? This is closer to your own neck. This is your neck of the woods.
It's a funny setup. Berkeley has another horror inflicted on it, and that's vacancy decontrol. If you move out, you'll never get another place because any landlord can charge whatever they like for an empty place.
It's not true in San Francisco?
I think that San Francisco has different horrors. I don't quite know what they've got in San Francisco. I know the burglary, which means everybody here stays put and holds on for dear life, and God help the students who have to move in into someplace new. Even if they've got scholarships and come from middle-class families, they're going to wind up, six in a broom closet, living on beer and pizza and yogurt.
You're a frequent Avenue watcher out here. Have you noticed has there been a detente between the police and the folks on the street with shopping carts, or are things heating up?
Well, it's the holidays, and the cops always shoo the street people aside because of the holiday shoppers. And that's bad, but that's true every holidays. The Salvation Army Santas are one thing, but...
The real poor are another.
Yeah. It sort of depends. It's more during the street fair than anything else. And it's no different than it ever was, that part of the thing. The crackdown on the street kids...
From last summer?
Yeah, it pretty much was so effective last summer, they don't... They don't keep it up much. They're not that many street kids around anymore. A lot of them moved down to Shattuck. Probably a lot of them moved over to the city where I don't think they'll be safe.
I know you wrote some very strong poetry on that subject, and you, of course, have your new book out, Ask a Mask, Julia Vinograd. If you're interested in getting a copy of this book, only $5, you can call 423-HUFF, and I will give you her address, or you can contact Zeitgeist Press. No.
What's your address, sir?
At 1630 University Avenue, number 34?
Yes, Berkeley, 94703. Book goes for $5. Send me a check. I'll mail you a book.
Good book, I might add. You're, what, 44th or 45th?
I think so.
So, any new poetry you've written after this book was published that we are destined to see in a forthcoming book?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you do some seasonal poems. I couldn't help it. I wrote one about a clown messiah who tried to save the world through laughter. And I like that one.
You will. Have you memorized it, or do you have it available to read?
It's fairly longish, and I don't know. Let me see. Hold the line.
All right. So you have two new poems.
Well, that you might like.
Okay.
One is called Homeless in the Fog.
Okay.
This fog so thick, so soiled, linen heavy, that the homeless climbing steep streets reach the city skyline and keep right on climbing. Fog above, fog below. Now, honey, a mother explains, say please, mister, and smile and do a nice curtsy, but don't cry or they'll want to get away. And don't start till I squeeze your hand. They'll want to feel they're the only one you trust to help. But let me smooth your hair. She reaches into the fog where her child used to be. She had every detail orchestrated so closely, there was no room for death. She hums soothingly to her chilly hand, waiting for a well-dressed man to walk around a warehouse in the clouds. Gypsy, who always has a feather in his squashed, impudent hat and who ran up the hill to make fat policemen miserable, sees he's walking on nothing, turns and thumbs his nose in case of police helicopters, then shrugs, sticks his hands in his pockets ready to explore, and glad he washed his hair last night. You never know. Further into fog, spare changers with plastic cups will run into clouds because they offended the eye. And in each plastic cup is a red offended eye throbbing and tracking like a searchlight, demanding, why am I here? Is there no place on earth for me? A veteran with an empty pants leg and a bottle dribbling into his beard wheels his rusted chair through fog. The cheap wine turns to stars falling out of his beard and then to pigeon droppings landing on the statues of famous generals far below him. The veteran leans over the side of his chair and spits. He's hung his purple heart on his bottle opener, and seeing fog instead of streets is nothing. He usually sees bloody jungles instead of streets when he has a flashback. So he supposes this sort of thing scares civilians. He wheels faster. His entire life is a hand grabbing the neck of an answer and shaking. Teenage lovers hold each other so close their tattoos get tangled up. They talk only with warm, shared breaths. Not even fog can be cold enough to forget. And there's a hawking cough that belonged to a muttering old bag lady with two yapping chihuahuas. Then the dogs died and the bag lady died, but the cough gets bigger and bigger, echoing through the fog and veined with the lightning like the last trump. There are so many homeless, so many. The fog throbs with their feet and they're too tired to stop. Soon there'll be no room for the answer that spends all history hiding. There may be no room for another day.
Pretty dense stuff.
Yeah.
And that was called?
Homeless in the Fog.
And this one is called?
The Clown. I suppose it's my seasonal poem. In this cold winter, a clown is born with a red squeaky nose and face paint that won't wash off. And when the nurse smacks him to make him cry and breathe, he'll laugh. He'll laugh till his mother wraps him in a blanket and leaves him at the circus. At the circus, he does miracles for audience come to applaud tricks and laugh. But as long as they laugh, it's a miracle. He takes eggs from his ears and listens to the chicken in the egg telling him his next joke as his face lights up. His trick lapel yellow flower squirts water into eyes and cures people of not wanting to see. His hair grows in as a clown's fright wig, and his feet are as big as his shoes.
He takes the starved starch jokes from politicians' speeches and feeds them pies fresh from his face and buckets of water that turn to wine when they drenched him till the jokes grow fat and sassy. And when the clown sends them back, the rest of the speech turns honest. When the circus is over, he tells jokes on the elephant's floppy ears, stormy jungle jokes that only elephants know. Laugh tracks come to him to be healed of loneliness. He strokes laughter till it purrs, like tickling their beloved belly buttons. He walks through jails and hospitals where people have a right to be angry, and he coaxes them to laugh at God because God's so funny and big. He goes into war in his baggy pants and red suspenders, pulling a red rubber duck on wheels. Neither side sees him as he tries everything to make God laugh. And if God laughs, we may be saved.
Oh.
Those are the new ones.
Do you know the name of your next book yet?
No. Give me a break. This one just came out.
We've got to keep you on your toes.
Yeah, but names come last. I have to write the book first.
And that was Julia Vinograd, and we're on the phone with...
Oh, hey, Robert. This is David Grace. Happy holiday.
Hey, David. You're on the air live on Free Radio Santa Cruz. You're
Oh, my God. My soul is being sucked through the air.
Yes, sir. You'd better just make sure you give us the right stuff.
Hey, well, actually, I just wanted to, you know, I work up at the Fillmore in Warfield, and I got some tapes. I'm down here this weekend, so I wanted to bring them down. I've never been down there. I know you don't want to say the location on the air. Do you want to put somebody else on, and I'll bring them down? This afternoon?
Sure. The other thing you can do is you can give me a call in about 10 minutes when I'm off air at the same number, and I'll try to talk to you.
Sure.
Right now I've got 7 more minutes in the show.
Good enough.
Thanks a lot.
All right. No sweat.
Bye-bye. Yes, sir. Tapes from Sister Liberation Radio San Francisco in our city to the north. Well, we are reaching the end of this marathon Bathrobe Spears broadside show. And we, of course, were listening to Julia Vinograd, another Street Scenes in Berkeley, recorded on December 22nd, kind of bringing you up there to down here. So you can see that there's a lot of similarity. We're going to be covering in the next show, where we return, 6 to 8 on Thursday in the evening, a number of topics we never really know quite what we're going to cover, but I'm hoping to cover Dolphin Lee again. That's the City Council's giveaway to Mercy Housing and eviction of dozens, scores, one might even say hundreds of people who are Hispanic and low-income in order to build a show affordable housing project that won't be affordable for the very people who are being evicted. And see how the City Council treats that. I'm going to make a comment or two about the last City Council meeting since it's going deeper and deeper into history and kind of disappearing, receding as we move toward the new year. But what happened at that City Council meeting was very important, I think, for an estimation of incoming Mayor Keith Sugar. I've, of course, commented critically on Sugar's failure to put on the agenda the emergency resolution of his Homeless Issues Task Force, unanimous resolution asking that the sleeping and camping ordinances be suspended pending safe zones, considering the violence, the shelter emergency, the hypothermia, the 5 deaths in 3 months. He wouldn't even discuss that. It wasn't even raised at oral communications, in response to oral communications. He wouldn't put it on the agenda. He wouldn't ask to be put on the agenda as an emergency item. He wouldn't do anything. We've already talked about that. My concern also is a pattern of disregarding the public and particularly singling out political opponents, of which I, of course, am key here. We've seen in the afternoon session of the December 14th City Council meeting how he repeatedly forgot to mention that there was public comment on numerous items. I had to interrupt the process of the council meeting twice to remind him that he had to allow public comment. Now, you might say, well, he's a new mayor. New, true, but he has also been on the council for a year. He has observed the process. And he seems to take the matter rather lightly. He interrupted me, as you've already heard, on one matter, the question of the recycling item. Then in the evening session, he cut me off, along with homeless speaker Daniel Hopkins, before we had a chance to speak, after twice extending oral communications to allow business people to speak. A very strange bit of behavior from Mayor Keith Sugar if he's to maintain his impartial or committed to public process credentials. We also are going to be hearing, and this will be on Thursday, how he treats a woman named Roxana Kistapache, who is a very pungent critic, formerly from the Beach Flats. She was a great advocate of the rights of people living there, even poor and Hispanic people, though she herself is not from another country, and she is, I don't think we call her Hispanic directly. She referred to the shenanigans going on in the closed legal session, how the city council was, again, behind the scenes making decisions to do this dolphinly eviction business without real public process. She was interrupted by council members Crone and Sugar, who told her that they did nothing at the legal session. And they were right. They were technically correct. At the legal session, they simply discussed a matter which they then later acted on at the afternoon session. So what they did was they gave her partial information, misinformed the public before television cameras that they had done nothing, took the wind out of her speech by interrupting her oral communication. But these two paragons of honesty did not tell the speaker, Roxanne, nor did they tell the public that they had, in fact, again, reaffirmed the Dolphin Lee acquisition, funded Mercy Housing to proceed with a $54,000 study how to deal with that property. Again, it's all proceeding step by step without real public discussion on why Dolphin Lee, why give it to Mercy Housing, why that rather than pick up housing from the Canfield Seaside Company that would actually expand housing and give people more places to stay without evicting Hispanic people who are themselves not going to find other housing once they're dumped out. We don't get that discussion, and we see that Crone and Sugar are following in the mold of all the politicians before them. In fact, they were the ones who interrupted Roxana Kistapache, guilty consciences that they must have, this is my interpretation, to correct her that no, nothing was done at the legal session without telling her that what she had said was done at the legal session was actually done with them voting in favor of it 2 hours later at the afternoon session. So it is becoming difficult for me to avoid being really quite clear that the new council members are like the old politicians. It was actually posed by David Silva and repeated by Roxana Kistapache, two great community activists, that Keith Sugar is going to be facing a dark night of the soul, or he was before the December 14th council meeting when he was urged by so many people to put this suspend the sleeping and camping ordinance on the agenda, even by his own professional $10,000 unanimous homeless issues task force after a year of silence on his part. And what Silva and Kistapache said was, this is the dark night of the soul for Mayor Sugar. Is he going to emerge Robert Kennedy or Scott Kennedy? And I think we have seen the answer. We have an incoming call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, just one comment. Here is the new boss. He's the same as the old boss. Don't get fooled again.
Hey, thank you.
Sure enough.
Well, you know, we really had a lot of hope, so it's kind of hard for a lot of us who put energy into the election and then continue to hold our tongues as buyers was essentially destroying any real discussion of repealing the sleeping ban, muzzling council members who dared to speak out differently, and then eventually coming up with this sad, dare I say, abortion of a proposal that came out of their final winter debate last year, which was a reduction of the fines for sleeping and very little else for homeless people. Then, of course, no mention of expanding shelter all year. But I'm afraid we can't really remain silent anymore. I mean, I certainly haven't remained silent on particular things that Sugar and Crone have and haven't done. But now it's time to be really clear. Based upon their performance at this council meeting on December 14th, above and beyond the whole issue of this emergency resolution, of course, which they failed miserably to do anything about, and Sugar broke his word on, comes the issue of their behavior toward the public, misinforming the public, trying to defang their critics by misinforming them. It's a really sad thing. Well, I have got to go. The help has arrived.
All right, off the air.
And I am getting evicted from the studio. Can you imagine? Well, now, I would like to protest this.
Excuse me.
I'm moving
gone
now.
You've well over your designated time.
I'm out of here. There's another phone call. I'm going to leave you until next Thursday, 6 to 8. Catherine Spears, Broadside.
Yes?
Thank God. God, that was getting so boring. 4.5 hours of Bathrooms, Pierre, Civil Rights. Doesn't that guy have two shows a week?
Thank you for the comment. I really appreciate
Play some fucking music.
You
faster. Should talk. Who is
Play some music.
Yes?
Robert has been evicted.
Not yet. I'm not out of here yet.
Well, you will be in a moment,
I'll
son, when I... divvy up my special brand of martial arts to your ass area. Well, I wasn't planning to start my show with talking.
Hey, I'm like 2 minutes
ago. Cut your hair and get a fucking job. I was going to play some music at the beginning of my show, but...
On Wednesday, I'm sorry, to their old spot on Sunday, saying they had understood it was all right if they didn't block walkways near the rink. Kolb said that Sunday night, park rangers again asked the group not to set up near the rink where a band would perform. The group members were told they could serve their vegetarian meals from a makeshift concession area in the square away from the rink, Kolb said, but they refused. "Do you really want the police involved?" Kolb recalls asking them. It was like they weren't listening. Park rangers and Los Angeles police then arrested them, but the activists recalled the events differently. Again, this is a story in the L.A. Times, I remind you, which is quite a broad sweep throughout the Southland down there. They say park rangers were out in full force waiting for them when they arrived. They described the arrest as a sweep that caught activists who were outside the disputed zone. They also say they can't understand why they can't feed the homeless wherever they want in a public park. "Feeding people in poverty shouldn't violate any park permits anywhere," said David Bush, who was arrested. "It's very disturbing to see a group trying to feed the homeless is arrested. It sends a terrible message. 7 were booked for standing in an area designated for use by permit only, according to Sergeant Rick Harris. Bail was set at $100 each. I'm surprised it's gone this far," Kolb said. "I would hope they would go right on feeding the homeless in another area of the park. We have no objection to that." This is the L.A. Times. Police arrest 7 activists in park dispute about arrests of food, not bombs. And I don't know. What do you make of this, James?
Just usual bull, you know. I mean, come on. It's the skating rink. I mean, it's the typical money over homeless. I mean, oh, my God, the people might see a homeless person or two partaking of a hot meal and filling their belly while they're out there spending their money skating on ice that cost all this money to set up, you know. Maybe that makes them feel uncomfortable. So police answer to the poor people feeling uncomfortable is to make the homeless person really uncomfortable. I mean, come on. You know, arrest activists for feeding people? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, interestingly enough, here's an eyewitness account. This is another email. End repression at Pershing Square. I heard about the street arrest through the LAAMN listserv. I went over to Pershing Square this evening, Sunday 26th, last Sunday, to offer my services to Food Not Bombs or to at least bear witness to anything that might happen. What I found when I got there between 5:15 and 5:30 was a place absolutely swarming with cops. You'd think there had been a riot or a shootout or some kind of terrorist act. The cops had even parked at a bus stop, so the people had to get out in the middle of the street to catch their buses. Now that has to be something that would inconvenience the citizenry a lot more than the mere sight of someone serving free food. The mere presence of all the armed thugs would be a lot more intimidating to the yuppie ice skaters than the presence of food not bombs could ever be. Does anyone know what happened to the food not bombs volunteers, asks this email writer. I know I got a letter a little late, wonder if the cops already swept them up and so forth. So he asks, we all need to rally in support of food not bombs. I think the denial of public space is really a serious offense against the people. No matter what cause we're working for, if we let the rich and the powerful chase us out of public spaces, then we might as well not have any rights at all. Free expression in public areas is just basic and fundamental, and yes, I think the act of serving free food qualifies as symbolic speech because it's a big slap in the face of an uncaring establishment. I work for a pro-immigrant group called La Resistencia, and we have had our First Amendment rights violated. Even though free expression was not our original issue, we had to do a lot of publicity and protesting for the authorities to recognize our right to leaflet on the sidewalk outside the downtown federal building. We even had a member who was arrested 3 times for the right to leaflet. He was denied a jury trial, and the prosecutor got my testimony and his support stricken from the record. Eventually, we did get what we wanted, a declaration by the building manager that we had free speech rights on the sidewalk. But who's to say the federal cops couldn't revoke that right at any time? We even heard a federal cop make this incredible Kafka-esque statement. Quote, if people are too stupid to realize they have freedom of speech, then they don't deserve freedom of speech. It seems that political activity in public space is under constant attack everywhere. Just look at Seattle. So I think the activist community needs to get involved in this in a bigger way. I think, at a very minimum, there should be a noisy, yet legal and peaceful demonstration on the sidewalks surrounding Pershing Square. Even if the park manager thinks he can control what goes on inside his park, oops, sorry, I mean the park he claims to operate on behalf of the people, it will be a bigger jump for him to claim he can restrict sidewalk activity. If Food Not Bombs calls for it, we should all turn out for our people there. I think there are some strong possibilities for coalition here. At a minimum, every organization that deals with poverty or hunger and homelessness or police brutality and repression or the misplacement of budget priorities on war and prisons at the expense of human needs should help Food Not Bombs fight for the park if they ask for it. And that was an email by Tom Louie. Again, about a situation in Los Angeles that's developing with the arrest, looks like now, of 8 people for serving food in Pershing Park, apparently over the wishes of an ice skating rink gang, even though Food Not Bombs have been serving in the area for, according to this, two years, twice a week. You know, we have a Food Not Bombs in San Francisco. I'm in San Francisco. Here in Santa Cruz, and of course there is one also in San Francisco.
Yeah, there's one in San Francisco, too.
Right. And they, of course, were suffering a number of arrests back in October, but since November, I guess the arrests have stopped. And even under His Majesty, Your Honor, Willie Brown, or Whitewash Willie, as I call him, the new mayor, thank you, Mr. Moneybags of San Francisco, it apparently hasn't stopped in other places. And, you know, I'm pleased to see that in Santa Cruz, at least for the last few years, the battle has been won around the free food issue. The last arrest for free food that I remember happening, well, they were confiscating food at the homeless vigil back in 1996, but they didn't really take us to the mat on that in front of City Hall, and we were protesting the sleeping ban over some of us, most of us. Well, a few were sleeping out, the rest were supportive over about a 7.5-month period. But there is still, I think, a concerted attack on people in public spaces here in Santa Cruz.
Absolutely. I absolutely believe that, you know, you have to be the right sort to use the public parks in Santa Cruz. I mean,
Do you have any basis for saying this, or are you just being one of your usual homeless ideologue self there, Jim?
My usual obnoxious self? No. Well, no, actually it is a basis. I mean, the thing that gets me is that you can see a large percentage of what you would call your tourist population, your newbies, your people that come in, use our services, and go away again. But they spend a lot of money. Okay? Well, these people are treated differently even than local people. And they can do things like drink in the park. They can do things like drink down by the beach and stuff. And it's no big deal. If something is said, it's called, excuse me, I'm so sorry, kiss, 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 and go away. If you're homeless or that type of person or look in any way like you're poor, you'll be run like crazy.
So, yeah, that's certainly, it's certainly true. You get the open container laws supposedly enforced against anybody with alcohol in public. that's an open container. But as we'll probably see tomorrow night, and I think that'll be a perfect place to see this, unless the police change their policies, we're going to see police targeting drunk homeless people, let's say, but ignoring, or let's say, shining on drunk middle-class people.
That's what I suspect
we're going to see.
I very much expect to see that tomorrow night. Very much expect. In fact, they've been gearing up for this. You know, we're getting our little special training.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
I have a New Year's Eve experience I'd like to share with you all.
Well, it's not New Year's Eve yet, son.
I know it's not. It's from 3 years ago.
Oh, go ahead.
With Officer Lamas of the Santa Cruz Police Department.
Is this Trigger Happy Lamas, as we like to call him?
Yeah, in fact, I call him Quick Draw Lamas myself.
You want to explain to the audience why you use that pseudonym or that...
Quick Draw Lamas?
Yeah, that cognomen.
Back in 1996, I believe it was the month of September, he was engaged in checking a man for a stolen car down... in a parking lot behind Pearl Alley, where there used to be a Baseline record store there. It's not Baseline anymore. It's something else, some hairdresser place. Behind the Pearl Alley and the Dakota nightclub back there in that parking lot. And he was, I guess, supposedly this guy was in the stolen car, allegedly tried to run the officer down, but I don't know how true that is. I wasn't there, but I do know that the officer responded by drawing his gun and firing 9 shots, I believe, 4 of which hit the car in different spots, and 5 of the bullets went flying, and one of them actually almost hit Sister Snatch, a programmer over there. It's going to be on tonight at 10 o'clock that night. But anyway, my story, back to my story with Lamas, that year, New Year's Eve, on 1996, December 31st, 96 to January 1st, 97, first night, I was downtown, and this was a year that we had actually set up a Food Not Bombs, and we were serving food at first night on the mall at the old hippie corner, Cathcart and Pacific, before that building was there. And anyway, so we had set up food, and we served for a while, and we were headed up towards the mall, towards the clock tower, getting close to midnight. And we tried to set up there, but that didn't work out. And after midnight, everybody was parading back down Pacific Avenue to go towards Benicio's Liquors, I imagine. And as everybody was parading back, and it was after midnight, it started to rain. And I personally, myself, hadn't had a drop of alcohol that night. I was planning on saving it until I was safely at home to get drunk and celebrate the New Year. And was completely sober walking down the mall. And I see, like you were just talking about how the police selectively enforce. And I, at the time had been in between homes, and I was like kind of couch surfing. I guess you could have termed me homeless at the time. And I was serving Food Not Bombs, and I was known to some of these police officers from various things. And I had been given a bottle of wine by this woman, this yuppie woman who had been drinking. And it was funny, she was like walking next to me. She was openly chugging from this bottle and yelling and screaming, Happy New Year, Happy New Year. And she was, like, obviously, loaded, not just with money, but, like, just drunk. Mm-hmm. And so she ends up handing me another bottle, a completely new, fresh bottle of wine, unopened. And Happy New Year! And just because I made a comment about how she was, like, drinking the bottle of wine. And she hands me this bottle. So I was like, thank you. I stick it in my pocket, and I didn't even open it. And I just put it in my pocket, and it was sticking out of my shirt pocket,
Did the police see this exchange or not?
No, I had it in my pocket. I walked down the mall, and I stopped in front of community television only because I saw Dan Hopkins on the screen, and I was trying to see what he was talking about, but
Dan
I couldn't.
Dan is a homeless activist.
Right, and at that time, the vigil had just broken up, I guess, a few months earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably what he was talking about. But anyway, I wanted to see that, and so I stopped. And the next thing I know, Lamas reached around me. Quick Draw Lamas reached around and grabbed this bottle out of my shirt pocket. It was like a flannel type shirt. So
Lamas is not just quick on the trigger, but he seems to be light fingers as well.
Yes, and he just like slipped in behind me, grabbed the bottle, and started to walk away. And so I like turn, I go, "Hey, what are you doing?" Right? And there's like all these other police officers there suddenly, like a couple of sheriffs, posse guys, And I remember Officer Bratt was there, too. He was in the vicinity.
Did he have his attack dog with
him? And Officer Sten. No, this is before he got the dog.
Hmm.
This is before they had that dog.
Mm-hmm.
And Officer Sten was there, too. And I started, you know, we get in this argument, and I tell him, I asked him to give me a ticket. I said, you're going to have to cite me and give me a receipt for that property you just took. You can't just take that from me arbitrarily. Oh, yes, I can. There's an ordinance. No grass on the mall. And I said, well, give me a ticket then. Give me a fucking citation. I will fight it, and you'll have to give me a property receipt for that, and you can't just go home and take it home and drink it after you get off work. He wouldn't give me a ticket. And he kept telling me, file a complaint. And finally, he just walked off, and he wouldn't arrest